There's something like 9 million accredited investors just in the US, right? For any one of us to be successful, I only need like a couple hundred investors. You know, if I want to go big, a couple thousand investors. That's not that many in the sea of accredited investors. And so my mindset started to shift. We started to position ourselves as thought leaders, to attract capital to us as authorities in our space, doing a lot more content, getting in front of audiences, virtual and in person, and starting to kind of build an attraction mechanism to bring capital to us.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Ben Frazier is the Chief Investment Officer at Aspen Funds. They're an Inc. 5000 company, and he's responsible for sourcing, vetting, and capital formation of investments. He has prior experience as a commercial banker and underwriter, as well as working in a boutique asset management group. He is also the co-host of the Invest Like a Billionaire podcast. So if you haven't checked that out, go check that out as well. Ben, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sam.
Absolutely. The pleasure's mine, Ben. There are three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. In 90 seconds or less, can you tell me, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah. So you kind of said a little bit. I was spent some time in banking as a commercial banker, underwriter, learned a lot, got to look under the hood of ultra wealthy borrowers of the bank. And my favorite thing was getting to look at their personal financial statements and tax returns. Learned a whole lot. Two biggest takeaways were the most wealthy borrowers were business owners and real estate investors. And I thought, hey, that's what I want to do. So had an opportunity to join Aspen Funds about 6 years ago now. I've become a partner and helping scale and grow the business and running my team. So it's been an amazing ride and just kind of getting started too.
That's really cool. What was the opportunity that you saw when you joined Aspen Funds? Like, what was the gap that you said, hey man, this is something I can fill and this is the direction we can take the company?
Yeah, well, I kind of got bait and switched, I like to say, in a certain way, because I was coming on as to be the VP of finance. So as a banker, you know, finance, MBA. So I was like, I'm going to go kind of more CFO route, kind of help with the finance side of the business. So I joined, you know, they'd been going about 5 years at that point, had only raised about 10 million bucks. So it was pretty small at that point, but it's an opportunity to help scale and grow something. But then very quickly they said, hey, you know, we actually need help raising capital, because that's, you know, really we need to scale. And I'm like, okay, that's not what I really signed up to do, but hey, I want to just help out where I can and grow. So learned very quickly. I had no idea what I was doing and tried all the wrong things, made a lot of mistakes, wasted a lot of money trying to do different campaigns. But fast forward 6 years later, we've raised over $200 million in equity from investors and continuing to scale up. So it's been a fun thing. I have an amazing team. It's not all me. I have about six different people that are on my marketing and investor relations team. So we just continue to be able to invest in good people, and I don't do any calls anymore, but still, you know, run that team.
Right. No, that's really cool. I'd love to hear a little bit more about those kind of mistakes and things that you say maybe you did wrong early on. But before we get there, let's talk maybe about what Aspen was doing then and maybe what it's doing now. Like, how has that changed?
Yeah. You know, I think it's important to have an agile business model, especially in real estate and investing, because the tides can change, right? And what you were doing before may not be a good place to be now. And what was really cool at the genesis of Aspen, it was really an opportunistic thing that our founder saw, and it was buying discounted distressed mortgages on homes, right? And at that point, coming out of the great financial crisis, they saw this opportunity. It was a great opportunity. But it really launched us. We continue to operate those funds. They continue to perform very well, but it's just not the same level of growth as we've seen in the past. And so several years ago, we started to take the same approach that we use to identify really good opportunity sets, really good, what we call macro-driven themes. So we're looking at the macroeconomic picture, trying to find where we think these long-term trends are going to kind of carry the next wave, and invest in those verticals. And so we have a few different verticals we kind of focus on and have expanded into a lot of different kind of asset classes from there, and continue to grow those.
Got it. What about the distressed mortgage business? What's that? I mean, what's that look like today? If you guys were, I asked this, this is kind of a leading question because I'm an investor in a distressed mortgage fund that is basically gone belly up at this point.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's not good, man. It's not good. I got a front row seat on telling you the wrong things to invest in. But it's gone belly up and I'm looking at it going, and they made some mistakes, I think, maybe 3 or 4 years ago where they ended up doing, they took these loans and they did workouts. Okay. I'm not in that business. You can tell, with the borrowers, but they were resetting at then, you know, the interest rates at that point in time, like, hey Ben, cool, man, we can rework your loan. I know you had 100 grand. We bought the loan for 20 grand. You know, we'll reset it for 70 and you can, you know, you can take the, we'll, you know, set it at 3 or 4%. Well, now nobody wants those. They can't resell them. Like the value of those loans has declined to almost nothing because nobody wants to take a 4% or 3% loan on their books because they're not worth anything because now it's what, 7% this going rate, something like that. Yep. How did you guys get around not getting caught holding the bag like that?
Yeah, you know, again, being agile, not both in a macro sense, but also a micro sense. So as the market kind of matured, we had to shift strategy. And so, you know, we saw that one of the biggest risks would be rising interest rates. And at that point, we thought it was a pretty minimal risk because we'd had low rates for a long time. But we always risk adjusted our pricing and we just kind of held to that and, you know, missed out on some opportunities, but just felt like that's, you know, we're taking more risk working with a borrower that is, you know, not as good credit quality as, you know, you or I. And so we risk price those to, you know, much higher interest rates. So our yields, our gross yields are generally in the 13 to 15% range. And so we've been able to stay right sized in that fund and still pay our investors their full preferred return and haven't missed in 11 years and, have, you know, still a pretty good, healthy portfolio. So it's, you know, call it some luck, call it a little bit of foresight and just good discipline, you know, throughout changing, times.
Right. And I think a lot of people are afraid of that. One of the things that we hear a lot of people say is, you know, don't fall prey to shiny object syndrome, which is a real thing, you know, where investors, they get involved. I'm one of them. I'll be honest. It's, you know, early on, you're like, oh, hey, what about this? What about that? That's really cool. That's really cool. But yet at the same time, there's a right time and place to be like, no, we're pivoting. We're not doing that anymore. Because as you said, very at the beginning that, you know, times change and you got to have to have an agile business model in order to adapt with the time. So really cool. Thank you for sharing that. Let's talk a little bit about the early on days of raising capital. You said you spent a lot of money, made a lot of mistakes, did some wrong things. Give us some insight there.
Yeah, you know, so I came in with pretty much no network. We didn't have a website that worked and no background in raising capital. I'd done some like sales jobs before, so I knew how to like talk to people, but you know, that was about it. So my initial thought was, hey, if I just go into rooms where there's wealthy people, we have a compelling product, compelling offer, I can convince them to invest with me, right? I mean, it's that simple. Money needs a place to land. We got a good place for it. You know, easy as pie. So we started doing, I mean, it's kind of funny because we go to this conference and there was this kind of service provider that mostly worked with financial advisors, which this is a very common lead generation tool where they go do dinner events. They send out mailers. They bring people to a fancy steakhouse. They do a whole, you know, dog and pony show and convert people to an appointment where you kind of talk one-on-one and then you know, get the assets. So they tried to apply this to fundraising. And so we tried this and, you know, I went to like a whole week long training of how you do these seminars and we went all in on it and spent a lot of money and had a lot of success from people coming to there and people that were interested. And then we had a really high conversion rate to appointment. So I'm like, man, this is working. So we'll keep doing this while we're working through the lead pipeline. And then at the end of the day, we did, I think, 3 or 4 of these events and they're costing us 15, 20 grand a pop. So, you know, we're dropping some change. And at the end of the day, I raised a big fat goose egg. And I was like, what just happened? Because people came, they were interested, they wanted to learn more, and I couldn't close them. And what was so interesting to me, you know, there's different reasons why people decided not to invest, but the ultimate one was they just didn't have enough trust in us. There wasn't enough of a comfort level knowing who we are, what we're doing. And, you know, we had a little bit of a track record, but, you know, this was, these were cold audience. And so very quickly learned, you know, the kind of idea of funnel marketing, but also in capital raising, building that trust is so important. And finding ways to shortcut that trust curve is like kind of really became my passion of learning how to do that. And so what really shifted was we, instead of like, my approach at that point was begging and groveling and just any dollar I could get, I would take. But, you know, it created the scarcity mindset to where it was like, if I don't close this investor on the phone right now, I don't know when my next investor is going to come and I need the money to, you know, invest in this deal. To an abundance mindset of, you know, I forget the number, it's changes all the time, but there's something like 9 million accredited investors just in the US, right? For any one of us to be successful, I only need like a couple hundred investors. You know, if I want to go big, a couple thousand investors. That's not that many in the sea of accredited investors. And so my mindset started to shift. We started to position ourselves as thought leaders to attract capital to us as authorities in our space, doing a lot more content, getting in front of audiences, virtual and in person, and starting to kind of build an attraction mechanism to bring capital to us. And then you build on momentum, right? Where you find where the momentum's rolling and you just double down, triple down, and just keep going. So it's fast forward now, we've raised a lot of money and I'm not working any harder, not necessarily any smarter, it's just doing the right things.
Right. No, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. That's time intensive on the front end. I think putting in those, positioning yourself as thought leaders, putting out content. I mean, what was the, it's like, you know, Google Ads or something like that. You know, they say on the front end, like you're going to spend the first 4-6 months and you're pouring in tons of money in an ad campaign. And the first 4 to 6 months of that, like there's just very little happening, you don't think. And then eventually, you know, you start to get traction with it. What would you say the timeline is for you where you said, hey man, we put in the hard work. Is that 12 months, 24 months? How long do you feel like before you start to really get your feet underneath you?
Yeah. You know, I think it's just, it has to be a mindset shift where we all want a silver bullet that if I just do X and I invest Y into it, I get out Z and I make all this money. Right. And it's never as simple as that. And I think I spent so long trying to find the formula that we could just pour money into that would just give us, you know, new capital. But it's like the quick fix, right? And in so much of what we're doing, you have to play the long game. And when you're doing content, when you're building an audience, when you're building a platform, whatever mechanism you choose, whether that's, you know, blogs, whether that's YouTube, whether that's a podcast, whatever it is, it takes time. And so for us, we started with SEO. We had some skills internally of being able to rank high in Google. And so we started doing that, writing articles and ranking high in Google for certain keywords and then doing layering on advertising on top of that. And then, you know, that became kind of the first flywheel that we could kind of build off of into other things. And so it took some time. It's hard to say exactly when it really kicked off, but I would say we spent probably a good portion of a year or two, like with this mindset of, we're just going to go hard. We're going to, you know, build this thought leadership platform with results along the way. But I would say at about that kind of 18 to 24 month mark, everything just started taking off, right? Cause you get a couple wins, you get on a couple stages and all of a sudden, you know, you just start to attract more. And then it's this kind of snowball that picks up steam and just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, you just kind of roll with it.
Right. I love it. Love it. Thank you for sharing that. Certainly appreciate it. We've got about 9 minutes left here on the show. I want to cover two things. One, I want to get your thoughts on what the current commercial real estate market looks like, and then what you guys are really going long in right now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting as we stand today, beginning of 2024, we're sitting on the back end of the fastest rate increases in history, and the market is still digesting. What does that mean? You know, how long is this going to be? When can we get our first rate cut, please, Jerome Powell? And it's, from my perspective, caused a misalignment of expectations to reality. And I think a lot of people are just wanting to go back to the old normal, right? What we were used to, really low interest rates, really cheap money. And I think we're entering into a new normal. And I think we're going to have rates higher for longer. What does that mean? I mean, anyone that knows, you know, some basic math, I know you have smart listeners, but, you know, higher interest rates, put a lot of pressure on higher cap rates, which really puts, you know, downward pressure on value. So I think we're seeing values being taking a hit in the short term, but we also see a lot of capital on the sidelines looking for places to invest, right? So I don't think we're going to see the next 08. You know, part of that was driven by a banking crisis, and we're not seeing the same level of a banking crisis. It's more idiosyncratic across different types of lenders that have maturing portfolios. But what I do know is that, you know, coming from a banking background, when the credit markets tighten and when investors get spooked, it's very difficult to form capital. It's very difficult to go get debt, very difficult to go get raise equity. And investors, they see maybe opportunity or the kind of beginning stages of it as the market kind of resets and goes into another bull run. But I think we're still very early in that. I don't think we have fully reset, number one. And number two, it's going to take some time for investors to have confidence coming back into, well, what is the new exit cap rate that we're projecting? You know, what is the economy going to do? And right now, what we're seeing from a risk-adjusted standpoint is kind of the private credit boom, right? This is the time of the market when private credit, it goes through a really big boom cycle because senior lenders are pulling back. A lot of times, if it's like agency or CMBS loans that you have on existing portfolios, they're requiring new interest rate or not interest rate, interest reserves that you got to bolster your cash reserves. Maybe you don't have enough capital to finish your business plan. You know, and so there's credit tightening there. It's difficult to raise capital from a capital call investor. So you can kind of come in and preferred equity, mezzanine debt, lower part of the capital stack, lower risk. You don't have the same exposure to cap rates continuing to go up or values to drop because you usually cap out at, say, 70, 75% loan to value. And then on new acquisitions, we're seeing a lot of this. Loan assumptions are the hot thing right now, right? Where you can go and assume an agency loan at, you know, low rates of yesteryear and be able to ride out whatever maturity is left on there. But generally, those are very low leverage loans, especially, you know, at the values a couple of years later. So you can kind of come in at that part of the capital stack. You can generally get really strong risk adjusted returns, you know, not quite equity like returns, but low double digits and on a net basis. And you're way lower on the capital stack. So it's from our standpoint, a very attractive place to be. We think it's going to be an opportunity for at least the next several years as a lot of these maturing loans start to hit and the market has to digest an enormous amount of supply of new, mostly housing and multifamily. So there's going to be a lot of turbulence in the market for the next 24 months, and we want to be positioned to take advantage of that.
So how does that work? Let's assume, I don't know, we're going to make up some fictional situation, or maybe you can make up a change the names for identity, you know, no one knows who they are. But what's a situation that you guys have encountered where someone has come to you and kind of walk us through how you guys look at the opportunity and then kind of how you help the borrower out in that situation and then how you protect your investors? Give me kind of some nitty gritty if you can without obviously telling actual stories.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's probably three situations that we generally see. One is gap funding. So I had a borrower just the other day, they're closing on a deal. They, you know, leverage is down, so have to raise more equity. It's really hard to raise equity right now. He had a big investor drop out. They're going to the closing table in like 3 to 4 weeks. I need $1 million. So we're coming in. This is a 90-day loan, and you know, we're charging high interest for this because it's, you know, money that he needs, and we're coming quick, and it's an asset-based loan. But in the course of the whole project, it's a very, very minimal cost versus not closing, right? So we can kind of come and help gap fund, and then we get paid off in 90 days. That happens fairly regularly. Another case I mentioned is a loan assumption. And generally loan assumptions, like for one we're looking at right now, they have a 2.9% assumable rate with another, I think it's 6 or 7 years in a really good submarket. You know, it's a, I think a 90s vintage property. So it's just, it's a great asset, but it's at like 45% leverage. So it's difficult to get their equity investors returns they want at that leverage point. So we come in, we're more expensive than the senior debt. You know, we're in the kind of mid double digits total cost standpoint, but it's still accretive to their equity investors who get all the upside, and we kind of get a contractual rate of return. and we bring the leverage up to a more normal scenario while they can still, you know, manage that a really good loan assumption. And the kind of third scenario is probably the more distressed rescue capital situation. This is, these are a lot more challenging because a lot of times basis dictates the future, right? If you just bought it at the peak and you levered it up to 80%, and we've seen a lot of deals recently, there's just no way you're not going to sell it at a loss. I mean, I'm sorry, I can't put any more money out this deal because you're already at today's value, you're over 100% leverage, right? So those are difficult situations, but there are situations where we're seeing where a lot of these senior lenders and bridge debt lenders are very, very desperate because they have a lot of issues in the portfolio. They get very aggressive. So we can actually go lower in the capital stack. They actually subordinate portions of their senior loan behind us. So they actually stand to lose significant amounts if there's a loss in the property before we ever get hit, even below the senior, not all the way below, but somewhere kind of in the behind them. So those are kind of the different situations we see and kind of the needs for the capital.
Right. So and I want to kind of pick that last deal apart a little bit and see if you can clarify some things on this. What you're finding is that there are bridge lenders out there, because obviously a loan is a lender's asset. So they have a loan on a deal, and that for whatever that deal is now in distress, and you guys come to them along with the borrower and say, hey, look, we can help bridge this gap.
Yep.
Or whatever. Not, I guess you use gap funding on the first deal, but we can come in and in the initial senior debt holder will now subordinate part of their debt to what you guys are bringing to the table. So you guys are now in position one in order to keep this deal moving forward. Okay.
Yeah.
For those of you who are listening, he's shaking his head. Yes.
I know your dad asked the question.
I am. Just making sure.
Yeah. So the idea on this deal in particular, it's they were doing the renovation plan. They had a bad property manager, drove occupancy way low, ate into a lot of cash reserves. They ran out of money to finish the renovation plan. They're stuck at like 70% occupancy because they don't have the capital to finish the renovation plan. They hit the business plan. They're hitting the market rents. They have a path to stabilization. They don't have any money to do it.
Right.
The senior lender is saying, we're not putting any more money out because our whole portfolio is, you know, in trouble. And they don't want to take it back because they have other deals they're taking back. And, you know, that's the last thing they want to do.
Right.
So we could come in and say, hey, we'll provide the funding to finish the business plan. But lender, we need you to subordinate to us. And in this scenario, it's almost a 2-to-1. So if we put $3 million out, they're going to subordinate $6 million of their senior portion of their loan behind us. So they have to lose $6 million before we even lose a dime of our capital. And that's, you know, last money in dictates terms, right? And that's just the reality is you can write the ticket and we have all the leverage because if we don't like the deal, we just won't invest in it. We won't put the money out. And so that's where you get a lot of, get into cherry pick.
Got it. That's really cool, Ben. I love that. I mean, that's amazing. One, that you get to dictate those terms and come in that position. I guess there's two further thoughts on that though, is that what is the hope from the sponsor's position? Like, what's the hope for them as it pertains to their equity investors? Are they eventually just hoping to just not lose the farm on this deal and make their investors whole? Is kind of that this is their Hail Mary to get out of the deal alive?
100%. I think a lot of sponsors in these situations have realized, wow, we're going to be lucky if we can get our capital back,
right?
Because a lot of these deals were purchased at historically low cap rates. And when the interest rates have reset and they're higher now, they can't even refinance because the refinance would require a huge capital injection. We all heard of cash out refinance, right? Most deals right now are cash in refinances. That's not the direction you want to see cash going. And so it's difficult because values have come down. We're kind of, I think, at the beginning stages of the worst part of this cycle, right? I think it's over the next 20 or 12 months, it's going to get pretty, pretty gnarly. And then hopefully kind of start to rebound up. But if you can just make it through the next couple of years, right, to where a lot of this distress of maturing loans has hit the market. I mean, the other kind of big wave that they're fighting right now is new supply, especially in Sunbelt markets. we're seeing record number of deliveries of new units because these were all started in the cheap money, you know, part end of the last cycle, and it's now all being delivered. And so we have 60% more new supply than the previous record hitting over the next 2 years. And so you're now competing not only with high interest rates, but now with tons of new properties, and they're getting very aggressive in leasing these up. So you just, if you can make it through the next couple of years, you can hope to ride out the storm and hopefully values recover a little bit. Hopefully we do have some lower interest rates and all those factors that you can't control, but probably in a better position a couple of years down the road can hopefully at least return capital. And maybe you can, you know, squeeze out some profits too.
Right. Right. And I think that's, I mean, one, I don't wish that on anybody, but it's also just an economic reality that I think a lot of sponsors probably need to take to heart, which is that, yeah, you know, the days of yesteryear of doubling our money in 18 months, which I was, you know, part and parcel, I was a participant in, had lots of fun doing it, but I think those days are behind us for the foreseeable future. So, you know, being honest with your investors and saying, hey, look, if we do the best we might do here, is get out alive. So if we can return your capital to you, I feel like we've hit a home run at that point. So that's a humbling conversation, but it's something I think we're just going to see more of. The last question I have for you on this, what's that conversation like with the bridge debt lender, the senior lien holder, saying, hey guys, we're going to come in as rescue. Like, how do you even start that? I mean, I would imagine that conversation, I'm just projecting here. So tell me if I'm right or wrong or how it actually works, I guess is the real question. But that, I mean, it's going to begin with a lot of like, no, answers in the beginning, because like, no, we're not subordinating our debt, and like, why? Like, how does that even work out? Like, how do you work your way through the legal and technical challenges of getting this whole sort of a deal done?
Yeah, attorneys definitely get rich in this scenario. So there's a lot of negotiations, a lot of, you know, redlining of agreements. But yeah, I mean, it really starts with, you know, knowing where our box is and knowing what we're not willing to capitulate on. And so it's really a matter of, here's your options. I mean, one of the options of the sponsor is if they don't get this capital, they give the keys back to the property. But from the lender's standpoint, what's their motivation, right? And if there's like, we're actually targeting certain bridge debt lenders, I'm not gonna say the names because hey, it's proprietary knowledge, right? But they have struggling portfolios, and we know they don't want to take back all their properties, right? And so if they have a certain number of property or a portfolio that's just struggling, they just want to kick the can down purely from an operational standpoint, right? They just can't take back as many properties because they're going to probably take losses in their capital. So it's understanding what their motivations are and the position they're in. Because in some deals we've seen with this lender, they're actually not in a negative equity position. There actually is a little bit of equity if they sold right now. Now the sponsor would lose capital. Sure. And so, but we don't have as much leverage to work with the senior lender. And so, you know, we have to kind of understand the position. And then we've actually just walked away from the negotiating table like two times already on this one deal. And I'm not even sure if we're going to get there. We're talking about a deal in my head that's, you know, in active negotiations. But it's understanding what their motivations are. And because I write the last check, I have all the power and all the leverage because I just walk away. I don't, because there's a lot of other deals out there that are looking for capital. And so it's you kind of have all the leverage in that position.
Right. No, that's really, really interesting. Ben, thank you for coming on the show today and kind of breaking down what it is you guys are doing currently, where you've been in the past. You've given us all sorts of insight, everything from kind of the mistakes you made early on raising capital to, you know, what you guys are doing now on the private credit side of things, where you guys see the market and just how you guys are positioning yourself for the foreseeable future. So certainly have appreciated you coming on today and sharing your insights with us. If our listeners want to get in touch with you and learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, you can check out our podcast, Invest Like a Billionaire. And then our private equity firm is Aspen Funds at aspenfunds.us.
AspenFunds.us. We'll make sure we include that there in the show notes. Ben, thank you again for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.